Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2001 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com/dialect. This week, part two of Stonehenge to Glastonbury and beyond. The rise and fall of the peace convoy with Brig Ubridge. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk and based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. If you have someone you'd like us to interview or would like to volunteer, have a pen ready at the end of the show. And we pick up the tale as Lord Cardigan takes pity on the travellers who've been attacked by the police at the Battle of the Beanfield in 1985. And gives them refuge in Savernack Forest near Marlborough.
Well, Lord Cardigan was actually the landowner of the land at Savernack Forest, where people had gathered together the night before going for Stonehenge. He was aware of what had been happening. You know, there was this big encampment of people on his land who were going to go for Stonehenge. And he actually rode along the following day on a motorbike, went down to see what was going on, and saw all the vehicles being smashed up by the police in the field, in the so-called bean field. He was outraged by it and very outspoken about it, and so he was interviewed and on the television news and so on, and was very supportive, because although he didn't necessarily want all these people on his land, he certainly didn't want to see British people being beaten up by the police in that way. A lot of the people who'd been part of that convoy left the country. Some went to Ireland, some went to Spain. A lot of them just went underground, and certainly from that point onwards, to get any kind of a festival site became really, really difficult, and there were no more green gatherings for a while, and there were no more free festivals for a while. The festival scene downsized itself. It went into little camps for a couple of hundred people, which was sufficiently under the radar. You could get away with it and rent a farmer's field for a couple of weeks and have a camp, and so long as there's maybe 300 or 400 people at the most, then you could get away with that and be under the radar and not cause a big kerfuffle. That went on through the rest of the Thatcher years into the 1990s. At the same time, well, Glastonbury was the only festival that really continued through that period. And then how I came to be organising the Big Green Gathering was in the early 90s, 93, I was organising the teepee field in the Glastonbury Festival. I was also running a small camp in the summer, which was called the Green Gathering and Creative Crafts Camp, where we had sort of green political discussions on the one hand and hands-on craft sessions in the other, kind of balance of head and hands, just as a small camp, one of these camps of 300 or 400 people. And I went around the green fields at Glastonbury Festival, seeing a lot of my old mates who had been part of the early green gatherings in the early 80s, saying, isn't it about time that we had our own big green gatherings again? Lots of people agreed, so we set up a meeting, out of which we set up a company to run the Big Green Gathering. It was done on a mutual basis. It was a quasi-cooperative in which people could be shareholders but only have one share each. So it was a democratic kind of setup. And so we ran Big Green Gatherings from 1994 all the way through till 2009. And when we set it up, we thought, oh well, it'll probably last 2 or 3 years and then go broke. because many people had tried to run festivals, and that was usually what happened. They spent one or two years establishing themselves, and in the third or fourth year they would blow it and go broke. But fortunately, with the Big Green Gathering, and I think because it had this democratic setup and people felt that they had ownership of it, people owned the company, people owned the event, and worked cooperatively to make sure it happened. Able to keep going all the way through the 1990s. We had a very interesting time in Wiltshire from 95 to 2000. And we were actually working with a chief superintendent in Wiltshire Police in Salisbury, who had been, at the time of the Beanfield in 85, Fred Pritchard was his name. He'd been in charge of Amesbury Police Station in 1985 when the Beanfield happened. He'd had to process 500 hippies through his police station in a night. And from that point on, Wiltshire Police were then spending over £1 million a year every summer on making sure that Stonehenge Free Festival didn't happen again and keeping any vestiges of hippies and convoys and festivals out of Wiltshire. It was a festival-free zone. And they were spending £1 or 2 million a year on it. And Fred was actually not all that happy with it. And when the Big Green Gathering in its second year, having been in its first year on a site at Watchfield in Oxfordshire, which was, that's another story, we found a site in Wiltshire. We were on Fred Pritchard's patch, and he came to us, and he clearly wanted to show there was a power struggle going on within Wiltshire Police between the existing chief constable who'd kept this spending on the, on festival-free Wiltshire going for over a decade, and those who would like to have brought that to a close somehow or other. So we managed to have an arrangement with Fred Pritchard where we, the Big Green Gathering, were actually the self-organised hippie festival that showed a festival could be properly organised, could take part in Wiltshire without turning into a totally lawless other Stonehenge. So he took the gamble of allowing it to take place, and we worked with Wiltshire Police, not always in total harmony with them, but nevertheless talking with them all the way through, being in contact with them and showing that we could have a festival which wouldn't be chaos, which wouldn't be taken over by lawless, unruly elements, and could actually run itself properly. And we did that near Longbridge Deverill from 95 to 2000. One year we had the police set up a searching point to search people for drugs, and there were, I think, about three people that year actually got strip searched by the police. And then we had an on-site naked protest against the police, and about 100 naked people swarmed around the police van. The police all hid in their van while this was going on, and then radioed for reinforcements. And it was all jolly good fun, and they didn't do the strip searching the following year. So, we had little ups and downs like that with Wiltshire Police, but on the whole, we worked together and made sure that we had an event which ran as well as could be expected.
I mean, have you got any advice for anyone thinking of or already organising festivals around this area of how you get a good relationship going with the police?
Well, we did all right in Wiltshire, and then we moved from there into Somerset. The Big Green Gathering shifted site to outside of Cheddar. We were there until 2009, and we found it more difficult there. The police upped the pressure on us every year by their demands in terms of licensing conditions, the amount that we were having to pay every year to pay for a police presence, to pay for the policing of the event, and to pay for private security. It was the police who determined, in the course of the licensing process, how much policing and how much private security we were going to have and how much we were going to have to pay for it. And the amount, despite the lack of any serious trouble on the event, that amount just kept going up and up year upon year. Then in 2009, we had gone through the licensing process. We had got our license granted us by Mendip Council. Then for some reason, in the last couple of weeks before the event was actually due to take place, the police started upping the pressure and producing all sorts of new hoops for us to jump through. They were contacting our contractors and saying, are you getting your paid in advance for this event? You need to make sure you're being paid in advance. And that put a big squeeze on us because actually people who were booking tickets were doing it online, and the online deal is that the credit card companies don't actually cough up the money when people book. They don't cough up the money until the day that the event opens. And so we had a cash flow problem with that. And then on the weekend before the event was due to open, it should have opened on the Wednesday, on the previous Friday night, the police had put pressure onto the local authority, Mendip Council officers, not the members who'd granted the license, but the officers in the office, to go along with the police's plan, which was to take out a High Court injunction to remove our license.
Shit, shit, shit. Whoa. Oh, yeah.
They served that on us late on the Friday evening. To defend it, we would have had to have been in court first thing on the Monday morning. Fortunately, we were able to get legal advice over the weekend, but it couldn't have been better calculated to try and prevent us doing so. And the reasons that they gave for wanting to take our license away were basically trumped up. They alleged a lot of things that weren't true, like we didn't have a proper security company, which we did, that we didn't have a proper agreement with the ambulance service, which we did. The one that we didn't think we could get around was a very minor one, which was that we hadn't got the road closure order on the roads around the site finalised, and that hadn't been rubber stamped by the man in the highways department of the county council who was supposed to do it, because he'd been under pressure from the county solicitor not to do it. Although it turned out after the event that the notices which would have brought it into effect had actually been put up all around the site and then taken down on the Friday afternoon. So we didn't defend the High Court injunction, because actually with all the uncertainty that aroused over the weekend, it meant that we couldn't get all our stewards on site and trained in time to properly steward the event the following week, and that would have meant that we would have been in breach of the licensing conditions anyway, even if we'd have gone to the High Court and got the event license restored.
Now, look, I hate to say it, but look, the Universal Convention of Human Rights, freedom of assembly, surely you shouldn't need to have the permission of the police in order to assemble.
Well, we didn't used to. When we started the Big Green Gathering, we didn't need to, because we found a wrinkle within the act that covered events at that time, which was that, and it was a music license that you had to have in those days for an event with music. You didn't need a music license if the music was incidental to exhibitions and displays. And with the Big Green Gathering, we were able to say, because all the stages were powered by wind and solar power and pedal power, that they were actually exhibitions of what you could do with renewable energy, and the music was incidental to them. That actually held water in law and meant that until the early 2000s, we were able to carry on the event without having to go through a licensing procedure. The first Big Green Gathering was about 1,500 people. By 2000, we were up to 10, 11,000. By 2007, we were up to 20,000. But the licensing law changed. The old Miscellaneous Provisions Act that the previous licensing came under went out, and a new licensing act came in, which also tightened up licensing for music in pubs and all sorts of things. There were a lot of controversy about it, because it meant that pubs and so on had to go through a huge new licensing process just to have a couple of people playing a guitar in a corner. But for the Big Green Gathering, it meant we had to go through a licensing process where we got a license off the local council. But the police, as well as the ambulance service and the fire service and so on, were statutory consultees in the licensing process, and that actually meant that whatever the police said got incorporated in licensing conditions, so they could dictate the conditions under which a license would be granted. But we managed to keep to those conditions. We were never prosecuted for any breach of conditions.
Well, it does effectively mean that if they want to, local police can just put impossible conditions to stop a festival, isn't it?
Well, that's what they tried over a number of years to do with the Big Green Gathering, and in the end, when they found they couldn't do that, they did this manoeuvre of a High Court injunction to take away the licence 4 or 5 days before the event was due to start. Had we gone to the High Court to contest that, then we wouldn't have been on site making the preparations for the event, which would have enabled it to actually proceed in an orderly manner that fulfilled the licensing conditions. So we were in a cleft stick, if you like. We were done one way or the other. Either we gave up our license and gave up the event, or we went ahead with it if the High Court allowed it, but still couldn't keep to the licensing conditions and got done for breach of conditions. So actually the event in 2009 didn't go ahead. The company had spent all its money on prepaying for the fencing and the trackway and the toilets and everything else, including the policing. And the people who'd paid for their tickets didn't get the event that they paid for. It was only afterwards that we found out that one of the key people, the transport manager for the main bar on site, was actually an undercover policeman called Mark Kennedy, going under the name of Mark Stone. And it was a few months after the Big Green Gathering had been closed down that he was unmasked as an undercover policeman who'd been reporting to the Association of Chief Police Officers. I have no doubt that the Chief Constable of Avon and Somerset at the time was getting information from the Association of Chief Police Officers. And it was certainly the Chief Constable of Avon and Somerset who was behind the operation that closed down the Big Green Gathering. Now, at the time, what Mark Kennedy would have known from his position in the bar was that that bar was making at least £10,000 a year out of the Big Green Gathering turnover in order to fund actions against climate change. So, as I say, we tried to get accreditation with the Pitchford Inquiry to pursue that point and try and find out exactly what was being passed on to Avon and Somerset Police and what that had to do with the closing down of the Big Green Gathering. But so far, we haven't got the accreditation that enables us to do that.
Well, I suppose that's the establishment not wanting to find itself guilty.
You may well say that. I really couldn't comment.
The Green Gatherings started up again over in Chepstow. How did that happen, and has it been reasonably successful?
That happened because, I mean, I retired after 2009, but others who were involved in the Big Green Gathering set up a new company and started producing the Green Gathering and found a site in Chepstow Racecourse, where they hadn't had events before. They wanted to have events. They wanted to find a new form of income for their site there. And it happened that Chepstow Racecourse was already in possession of a licence for events. So they became the licensee rather than the event. So that made it a different kind of situation in regard to the licence. And it was also a very different kind of situation with the local authority, because whereas Mendip Council had already got Glastonbury Festival and used to being vigorous with its licensing of events and used to having an event that was big enough that it could actually meet any demands that were placed upon it, and the police likewise were used to having an event there that could stump up vast amounts of money for policing, vast amounts of money for security and so on. In Chepstow, it was an area that was starved of events and was really keen to have an event there, so they've had a much easier time with the licensing there. And it was after the Big Green Gathering collapsed, it was knocked back and it was small again, like the Big Green Gathering had been. That started off with 1,500 people the first year. I think the new Green Gatherings at Chepstow started off at about that size but have built themselves back up to 6,000 or 7,000 now, and are going well. I go along every year as a participant, but no longer as an organiser. I'm happy to be retired.
Do you think the days of the Free Festival are over then in Britain?
The days of the Free Festival have been over since 1985. And actually, I think Stonehenge Festival, as it happened, and the amount of out-of-orderness, if you like, that happened there, at a time when the country was fairly out of order because there were riots going on in the inner cities and there was the miners' strike, there was a lot of disorder in the country as a whole, that showed that actually you can't have a big event without having some kind of security, some kind of order and sensible health and safety rules and enough toilets and enough planning and so on. You can't just say we'll all meet up at such and such a place and bring what you expect to find and we'll have a festival, because that was the way that Stonehenge and the Free Festivals were set up in the 70s and 80s, and it worked okay up to a certain size. You could do it with an event up to 5,000 or 6,000 people, so long as you had people who all went with a goodwill and with that intention that the Free Festival is one where you bring what you expect to find and you make it good by what you bring and what you put in. And you could have that sort of free will gathering up to that kind of size. But if you get much beyond that, then really it does need a bit of organisation and a bit of order. But it can be done in a way that retains the cooperative spirit and a feeling that everybody owns their share of it and it's what you bring to the festival that makes the festival. I think that's how the Big Green Gathering worked, how the Green Gatherings continue to work. And it shows that there is hope for self-organised human beings of goodwill.
What do you make of the modern day? Because English Heritage have allowed some sort of event at Stonehenge in the summer solstice now.
Well, that again, we were involved in that because the English Heritage actually called in the organisers of the Big Green Gathering as consultants when they were talking about opening it up at midsummer again for the first time. That was part of this process of normalisation that we went through involving Fred Pritchard and Wiltshire Police and the Big Green Gatherings when it was in Wiltshire. We actually supplied English Heritage with stewards the first time that they opened it up again on Midsummer. I'm dismayed at the moment about the fact that they've gone back on saying that it would be open for free at Midsummer, and now they're charging £15 parking for anyone who goes along at Midsummer. I think that's a retrograde step, and given the amount of money that English Heritage makes all through the year out of Stonehenge, it's unnecessary and a backward step. But it's good that it is open on the solstices and the equinoxes for people to actually go there and use it as a temple, people who feel so inclined. But I don't think we'll ever go back to the kind of disorganised free-for-all Stonehenge Free Festival that we had in the 70s and the early 80s.
One quite interesting spin-off, I was watching a programme, maybe last year sometime, one of the people involved in the convoy, the peace convoy, was this guy Dale Vince, who's now started up a eco power company in Stroud. He's also running Forest Green Rovers, a football team up there. It's almost like you've got, is it the yuppies, the idea of the, or the yippies, that some hippies can become very commercially successful?
Yes, I know Dale, and he wasn't only at free festivals and on the convoy, he was also part of our crew in the Molesworth Rainbow Village in that winter, and he was with us when we got evicted by Michael Heseltine. And he's done very well setting up Ecotricity, and I take my hat off to him. Yeah, and I can remember in the late 80s, he'd turn up at Glastonbury Festival with a fire engine with solar panels on the roof and wind turbine off the corner and set up charging people's phones for them in the green fields at Glastonbury Festival. In a way, it's the same as I went from being a person involved in free festivals and that, taking that kind of anarchistic approach to running a festival organising company that got its licence and dealt with the police and dealt with the authorities and did everything by the book. He's done the same in power generation and gone from being a hippie generating power on the side of his truck and just powering people's mobile phones for a quid a charge up to actually running a company that's a major electricity supplier and part of the renewable energy revolution on a national scale. I've heard him say, and I would say myself, you know, we've come through life from small beginnings and being kind of on the outside of society doing things that were so far out of the mainstream that you had to be a dropout to be doing them, to a point where many people like us have said, no, we actually have to take this into the mainstream of society. We have to make it available to people throughout society. It's not a sellout to actually be properly organised and to work through company structures. And I take my hat off to Dale Vince.
Are there any other spin-offs that you can think of from people who've gone on to do interesting things who were... Because it was, a creative crucible, really.
There are, and I keep running into them every now and then, people who were around in the old days. And you're right to say it was a creative crucible, and it's produced lots of people in the arts who... see from year to year at Glastonbury, at other festivals, in events like the London Olympics opening ceremony. There were lots of people who'd come out of festival culture who were part of that entertainment that went on there. There's lots of ways that these things have come back into the mainstream in an age which is more ready to accept them into the mainstream now and to understand what people were on about when they were just viewed as weirdos on the edge.
How about drugs, though? Because this is one of the fingers that Heseltine would wagging at the convoy, wagging at the free festival scene, that this is just a hotbed of drug dealers and... I mean, surely that must have been a problem.
It's a problem of prohibition. It's the same as the problem that they had in America when they tried to prohibit alcohol. When you prohibit something, make it illegal, then it becomes something which is used by gangsters to make money. People who were involved in the early free festivals, they were potheads and probably a lot more calm and laid back and unlikely to get into fights than the average alcoholic drinking person down a pub. But when the gangsters started bringing in the hard drugs, when the heroin and cocaine and so on came along, that was actually very vigorously opposed by most of the people on the ground at the free festivals. A mate of mine, Sid Rawl, who was a very prominent and viewed by the authorities as a kind of organiser of Stonehenge. He's not afraid to put himself forward as a kind of figurehead. Was actually threatened at Stonehenge in 83, I think it was, by heroin dealers, and had guns pointed at him and fired at him, and actually ended up under police protection towards the end of it, because of the stance that most people at the festival took vehemently against having any hard drugs on site. And that is a problem, and as I say, it's what comes with creating an illegal situation like you had with the prohibition of alcohol in America in the 1920s, which plays into the hands of gangster culture. And it is a tragedy of the second half of the 20th century, really, that throughout the West we had this so-called war on drugs, which was never going to be won. And because it failed to take a sympathetic attitude to a bunch of potheads in the 1960s, then helped create a drugs and gangsterism problem that is still with us today and caused all sorts of problems in producer countries from South America to Southeast Asia.
Organised youth, and a lot of youngsters now seem to want to get, I mean, you could almost talk about them as the Corbynistas, some of them, these young people who have joined the Labour Party. What message have you got for them, lessons from your time in the 70s and 80s, as an organised, like literally physical opposition to an authoritarian government? Because that's where we seem to be again now with the Conservatives.
The first thing I'd like to make clear is that you're talking to someone who's been a committed member of the Green Party ever since 1979. So one of the first things that I'd say is you can't necessarily trust the Labour Party, and Corbyn himself isn't necessarily in charge of it and won't be there forever. But certainly back in the day, back in the 70s, back in the 80s, we had a lot more freedom to do things. We were a lot. It was a lot freer to organise. We had lots more civil liberties. We could do things without having to be licensed. We could do things that, you know, from squatting empty houses to squatting fields and having festivals, and having demonstrations and sit-ins and.
Because there's a lot of talk today about the sort of dark days of the 1970s.
Well, at least in those days, we did have a lot more traditional civil liberties, freedom of association, freedom of assembly. And the laws applying to those things have been progressively tightened and tightened and tightened over the years of my lifetime. And squatting, for example, after the Second World War, when there were millions of people in this country without houses, there was a huge squatting movement that went on in disused army bases, in Nissen huts all over the country. There were families squatting in MOD property. So that there was use of these freedoms that we had then in ways that simply aren't allowed now, and the laws have been more and more tightened over the years. But there's always hope, and there's always ingenuity, and people find new ways of protesting, new ways of doing things, and there's actually an awful lot more communication now with the internet and the World Wide Web and social networks and so on than was ever possible in, I say, my day. I'm still around, I've not gone away yet, but in earlier times, shall we say. I say, just go to it. If you know you're right, then go ahead.
I mean, I suppose one of the things you can do on the internet is make contact with people on a similar wavelength almost anywhere in the world.
You can, and of course you have to be aware that whatever contact you do make is being monitored by the security services, who've got computers that will look for code words, keywords, and so on. So we're under greater surveillance than ever before, but we've got as great a capacity as ever, stand up for what we think is right and make a difference to the world.
Do you think there's a bit too much paranoia about the internet? You're talking about surveillance there, and it's one of the things I picked up from, partly to do with the peace convoy. This was at the same time that Duncan Campbell in the 1980s was revealing Menwith Hill as a spy base, spying on all the phone calls and this sort of thing, with lines, digital lines, straight into the British phone network that the National Security Agency was using to spy on us. How do you get that balance between being free and organising and actually making sure that what you're not getting too worried about being watched at the same time?
Well, the first thing is keep it peaceful and don't do anything that would actually add up to terrorism and putting people's lives in danger and so on. You know, stay on the right side of that. And if you do that, there's an old Doors song that says, "They got the guns, but we got the numbers. Gonna win, yeah, we're taking over." There'll always be an advantage in terms of numbers. They can't be listening to everybody's phone calls all the time. They can't be, even with the computers, they can't be spying on everyone's emails all the time. If we got the numbers, it's a matter of enough people getting involved, then a difference can be made. And anyway, it's a matter of numbers, because every government, as they said in the American Declaration of Independence, governments derive their just power from the consent of the governed. If enough people get together and say, "No, you haven't got our consent for this," then in a democracy it can't happen. But it's a matter of getting enough people together and motivating enough people. And actually, with the internet communications that we have nowadays, we can motivate and mobilise people on scales that have never been seen before.
And do you think, for some people, they just want to stay completely off the internet, disconnected from it totally? So is there a case for that as well?
There is, and I don't do social networks. I don't do Facebook or Twitter. You can get into a position where you spend all your time just looking at a screen, and I like to have a life in the real world as well. I'd rather spend my time digging my allotment than sitting over a computer all the time. But you know, it has its uses as well. It's a matter of maintaining the balance and keeping your feet on the ground and your wellies in the mud at the same time as being able to cope with the technology and the benefits that brings.
And you're a Green Party activist, but a lot of people would just point at the Green Party and say, well, there's nowhere, they're anywhere near power. It's the Labour Party you've got to join if you really wanted to stand a chance of changing things, like, for example, the Labour Party did in 1945 with, you know, the big nationalisation, the introduction of the health service, that kind of thing.
Well, the Labour Party did very well in 1945, and then it brought in Britain's first nuclear weapons programme. And then a lot of people would say it continued to sell out in the 60s and 70s under Wilson and then Callaghan, and then in the 90s and 2000s under Blair. I like to be on the side that's got it right, and whether that actually brings us to power ourselves or just pushes our ideas up to the top of the political agenda, I don't really mind at the end of the day. I'm glad to see Corbyn's Labour Party having adopted half of the Green Party's manifesto from the 2015 general election. I wish they'd adopt the other half as well, but I think we're making progress one way or another. But I think actually the two-party system leads to corruption and leads to sellouts, and the lack of proportional representation in this country means that you get two big parties that get a disproportionate share of the seats in Parliament and have to pander to middle ground floating voters to tip the balance one way or another, and other people elsewhere on the spectrum are never properly represented. And history shows that you need other voices in there in order to keep people held to account and on the straight and narrow and on the right track. So that's why I'm part of the Green Party and will continue to be part of the Green Party, and I think that they're absolutely essential to keep guiding our political system towards the sustainable future that we all need.
That was Brig Ubridge, who was on the Peace Convoy and now is an organiser of the Green Gathering in Chepstow every year. That's all for this week, Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. Subscribe to our email list and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guest, Brig Ubridge, and to studio engineers Dave Bazanko and Joss Chivers. Dialects, a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. If you have some of your precious time to spare, you can volunteer with us, or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. Thanks for listening to Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. I'll be back on Friday with my two-hour BCFM politics show, live from 6 till 8 p.m. Meanwhile, till next Tuesday midday from the Dialect crew, goodbye for now.
It is nothing. My age, it means less. The country I come from is a part of the free West. I was taught and brought up there, its laws to abide, and that the land that I live in has God on its side. Oh, the history books tell it, they tell it so well. The cavalry's charged, the Indians fell. The cavalry's charged, the Indians died. For the country was young with God on its side. Oh, the First World War, it came and it went. The reason for fighting I never could get, but I learned to accept it with pride. For you don't count the dead when God's on your side. And then the Second World War, it came to to an end. We forgave the Germans, and now we are friends. Though they murdered 6 million in the ovens they fried, the Germans now too have God on their side. But now we have weapons of chemical dust, and if fire them we're forced to, why then fire them we must. One push out the button and a shot the world wide, and you never ask questions when God's on your side. Oh, many a long hour I've thought on this, that Jesus Christ was betrayed by a kiss. But I can't think for you, you will have to decide whether Judas Iscariot had God on his side. And now as I leave you, I'm weary as hell. The confusion I'm feeling, there ain't no tongue can tell. The words fill my head and drop to the floor, that if God's on our side, he'll stop the next war.